Devim Sarasatim Vyasam Sato Jayamudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naistiki. This morning we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 3, Chapter 23, entitled Devahuti's Lamentation, text numbers 14 through, we'll have to see. Divyopakaranopetam. Divyopakaranopetam sarva kala sukhavaham patikabhihi pathakabhir vichitrabhir alankritam sragbir. Divyopakaranopetam sarvakala-sukhavaham patikabhi-pathakabhir vichitrabhir-alankritam divyopakaranopetam sarvakala-sukhavaham patikabhi pathakabhir vichitrabhir alankritam divyopakaranopetam sarvakala sukhavaham patikabhi pathakabhir vichitrabhir alankritam divyopakaranopetam sarvakala sukhavaham patikabhi pathakabhir vichitrabhir alankritam Shagbir vichitra malyabir mandu shindat shadangribihi dukulakshama kaushayayar nanavastar virajitam divya. Wonderful. Upakarana. With paraphernalia. Upetam. Equipped. Sarvakala, in all seasons, Sukha Avaham, bringing happiness, Patikabihi, with festoons, Patakabihi, with flags, Vichitrabihi, of various colors and fabrics, Alankritam, decorated. Shragbihi, with wreaths. Vichitramalyabihi, with charming flowers. Manju, sweet. Shinjat, humming. Shat angribihi, with bees. Dukula, fine cloth. Kshama, linen. Kaushayai, of silk cloth. Nana, various. Vastrayi, with tapestries. Virajitam, embellished translation. The castle was fully equipped with all necessary paraphernalia, and it was pleasing in all seasons. It was decorated all around with flags, festoons, and artistic work of variegated colors. It was further embellished with wreaths of charming flowers that attracted sweetly humming bees, and with tapestries of linen, silk, and various other fabrics. This is a description of the latest model of flying palaces. And certainly sounds like it would be something that every household would want to have, equipped with all facilities for comfortable living. I'll go on to describe. Upari upari vinyasta nilayeshu prithak prithak kshiptai kashipubhi kantam paryanka vyajanasanai. The palace looked charming, with beds, couches, flags, festoons, fans, seats, all separately arranged in 7 stories. Purport. It is understood from this verse that the castle had many stories. The words upari upari vinyasta indicate that skyscrapers are not newly invented. Even in those days, millions of years ago, the idea of building many-storied houses was current. They contained not merely one or two rooms, but many different apartments, and each was completely decorated with cushions, bedsteads, sitting places, and carpets. Tatra tatra vinikshipta nana shilopa shilpo pashobitam maham marakatastalya justam vidruma vedibihi. Its beauty was enhanced by artistic engravings here and there on the walls. The floor was of emerald with coral daisies. Purport. At the present moment, people are very proud of their architectural art, yet floors are generally decorated with colored cement. It appears, however, that the castle constructed by the yogic powers of Kardama Muni had floors of emerald with coral daisies. Vasu vidruma dehalya bhatam vajra kapatavat shikareshu indranileshu hemakumbaya adishritam. The palace was very beautiful, with its coral thresholds at the entrances and its doors bedecked with diamonds. Gold pinnacles crowned its domes of sapphire. Chakshushmat padmaragrair vajra bittishu nirmitai justam vichitra vittanair maharhair hematharanai. With the choicest rubies set in diamond walls, it appeared as though possessed of eyes. It was furnished with wonderful canopies and greatly valuable gates of gold. Purport, artistic jewelry and decorations giving the appearance of eyes are not imaginary. Even in recent times, the Mughal emperors constructed their palaces with decorations of jeweled birds with eyes made of valuable stones. The stones have been taken away by the authorities, but the decorations are still present in some of the castles constructed by the Mughal emperors in New Delhi. The royal palaces were built with jewels and rare stones resembling eyes, and thus at night they would give off reflective light without need of lamps. Hansa paravata vrata istatra tatra nikujitam. Kritiman manyamanai swan adirudhyadirunyacha. Here and there in that place were multitudes of live swans and pigeons, as well as artificial swans and pigeons, so lifelike that the real swans rose above them again and again, thinking them live birds like themselves. Thus the palace vibrated with the sounds of these birds. Viharasthana Vishrama Samvesha Pranarajira Yato Pachova Samrachtair Vishampasami Vatmanaha. The castle had pleasure grounds, resting chambers, bedrooms, and inner and outer yards designed with an eye to comfort. All this caused astonishment to the sage himself. Kardama Muni, being a saintly person, was living in a humble hermitage. But when he saw the palace constructed by his yogic powers, which was full of resting rooms, rooms for sex enjoyment, and inner and outer yards, he himself was astonished. That is the way of a God-gifted person. A devotee like Kardama Muni exhibited such opulence by his yogic power at the request of his wife, but when the opulence was produced, he himself could not understand how such manifestations could be possible. When a yogi's power is exhibited, the yogi himself is sometimes astonished. It's an interesting title for this chapter, especially leading up to the end of the chapter. It's called Devahuti's Lamentation. So Devahuti came from a very wealthy family and was accustomed to good standard of living. And when she met her husband, she was accompanied by her parents. And this is often the custom in India, that the girl goes to the house of the husband, and of course her parents accompany her, and she often returns to the house of her parents, at least in the early years of marriage, because it may be in case she has any doubts or problems in those early years of marriage in terms of adjusting to her new family and her new life. And Devahuti certainly had to make a big adjustment, because her husband was not exactly living in Beverly Hills. Rather, he had practically no facility to satisfy his wife. In fact, he didn't even make an effort. He carried on with his activities of worship of the Lord, austerity, penance, etc. But Devahuti, being a chaste wife and chaste lady that she was, she followed him. So there might have been some lamentation there that she had to leave her household and accept such an austere life. Certainly, this description here is not one of lamentation. She served her husband, and she got the fruit. She got, her husband pleased her in a very wonderful way. And one can accrue pious activities and use them something like a bank account to get a good birth or material opulence or knowledge or whatever. And this does happen to yogis, that they actually prolong their existence in the material world because they perform some austerity and then they take some benefit from the performance of that austerity. And of course, we don't have much experience of mystic perfections, although they are described in the Shastra. Little things you can still see today if you're really into it, if you want to you know, strengthen your faith. You know, you don't believe in all this mystic city stuff. Well, you can go to India and you can actually see there's a few yogis still hanging around who have got some Shakti. And you can see even, I mean, there's one guy in South India who's a magician, but there's a lot better stuff than him. You know, the guy with the afro haircut. He gives watches, but you can get those in Switzerland or, you know, Ladus or whatever. But there's a lot better stuff like than that in the Himalayas. You can actually meet people who have some little mystic siddhi. The problem is that if you're not fixed on the goal, the ultimate goal to attain the lotus feet of Krishna, which is free from any desire for fruitive return, anyavilashita shunyam jnana karmadi anavritam. This is bhakti, which is ahoituki. It's not a business deal. Mukti bhakti siddhi kami shokali ashanta. The siddhi kamis, those who desire mystic perfection, those who get mystic perfection, and those who use their mystic perfection for some enhancement of material life. And that does happen, that someone gets some mystic perfection and he uses it to exploit others. One mystic perfection is that one can mesmerize a huge audience. One can, you've heard of hypnotic, you know, hypnosis and control. Well, a mystic yogi can control a huge crowd, 5,000, 10,000 people by his, he's got the ability to hypnotize people. And what to speak of hypnotizing some individual or some disciples or whatever, and he can exploit them for his sense gratification. Therefore, it is said that for a yogi to control sex desire is possible by regulation, but even greater than the desire for sex is the desire for power and for followers. Anyway, Kardama Muni, being a Vaishnava, did not lose sight of the goal of Krishna consciousness, but when he used his mystic powers, he himself was quite surprised at the result, because he had never spent anything from his bank account, and he was really surprised at what he got. And this type of aerial mansion, there are descriptions in the Ramayana of Ravana's aerial mansion also, that it was incredibly opulent. In fact, Ravana got his aerial mansion from his brother Kuvera when he conquered the demigods. He stole a lot of stuff. Whatever you found in Lanka, a lot of it was stolen from the heavenly planets. Of course, he created some more, but most of it was stolen property. That's generally how demons live, on stolen property. Of course, everything is stolen from Krishna, but his aerial mansion was so wonderful that you didn't have to get behind a steering wheel and drive it or something, you know. It could pick up your mind, your thoughts, the mansion itself, I didn't have a Ford engine in it. I don't know how to describe something that can go anywhere just because you're thinking of it. You know, I want to go here to this place in the Himalayas, or I want to go here to this pleasure grove or whatever. There are various places where beings from higher planetary systems go for their holidays, and the aerial mansion that Ravana had could go in any place in the universe, and it could go up or down, forwards or backwards, just by thinking, by the person who was the owner of the Aerial Mansion, whatever he would think, it would go there. The problem is that, again, bhogaisvarya prasaktanam tayaparita chetasam, when we are surrounded by material opulence, we lose our presence of mind, we lose our ability to discriminate, we become animals again. Punar mushiko bhava. We become just like animals. Human life is meant for self-realization. So you go through 8,400,000 species, you struggle all the way up, going through all kinds of miseries. And you get to the human form of life, and what do you get? The ability to discriminate between matter and spirit. That's a valuable gift. The ability to discriminate, to use your intelligence to decide what is temporary and what is eternal. In other words, sense gratification is temporary. Whether you go from Brahmalok to Patalok, all kinds of sense gratification are temporary. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that those who worship the demigods are foolish, because whatever pleasure they get from the demigods, either by getting some boon from the demigods or even going to the planet of the demigods, whatever facility they can hope to get, it's limited and it's temporary. So the human form of life gives you this opulence to discriminate between real happiness in relationship to Krishna and temporary happiness, no matter what standard it is, of sense gratification. So here, Kardama Muni, he achieved perfection in controlling his senses. Therefore, when he did engage in his obligation to satisfy his wife, a householder's duty is to satisfy his wife in all ways. After all, each Devahuti satisfied Kardama in the way that he wanted. So it was his duty also. And when he did do that, he did not get bewildered. So nothing is wrong and nothing is right in this material world. Dvaite badra badra gyan sarva manodharma. Simply mental concoction. It's simply our mental concoction. If we think a bala, this is good. A manda, this is bad. It's simply an illusion. There's nothing good and there's nothing bad. And yet, we are following some regulation. No illicit sex. And not only that, but if you take the very strictest definition of that, no sex except for procreation, and that once a month on the optimum day. So this is actually the best use of our facility in the human form of life, our power of discrimination. We see that there are other people who claim to be looking for spiritual knowledge, but their conception is that the material world is just a backdrop for sense gratification. God gave us this world, and we don't want to have a lot of children, or just enough that we can support them. So have sex as much as you want, but in their church they say only on those days when you won't conceive. Just see the difference. Our process is that sex is natural and children are natural. So have sex only on those days when you will conceive. And the Catholic Church's idea is contraception, only on those days when you will not conceive, then you should have sex life. So what does that mean? It means they want to enjoy sense gratification. We've got a higher standard of sense gratification. We also want to enjoy sense gratification, but we know that whatever you get in this material world is imperfect. It's temporary. It's limited. But as long as you buy this ticket, you can't get that ticket. You spent your money. You don't have anything left. You can't go to both places at the same time. You can't love God and mammon at the same time. We have to be finished with this material world. And we have to use our intelligence to judge how we can get the result. Nothing is wrong, nothing is right. The only thing that is absolutely right is prema. Not kama, but prema. They're juxtaposed. One is the perverted reflection of the other. Kama is the perverted reflection of prema. So we want to ultimately develop that ecstatic happiness which comes from loving Krishna and which is eternal. And this is certainly opulent. It's incredible. Relatively speaking, we can't imagine this. We've never seen floors made of emeralds and diamonds and rubies. And you know, we get one little diamond and we've got to put it in a showcase in a museum somewhere. But here's a building where everywhere there's diamonds and jewels, etc. So this is incredible opulence. But will it last? When Hanuman got a little upset with Ravana, he just smashed the whole palace of Ravana. He yanked out one of the giant pillars. Here's this monkey, mischievous monkey, Hanuman. That's what they thought he was, a mischievous monkey that will just light his tail on fire and punish him. Ravana thought that what's the most important thing to a monkey? His prestige is his tail. So light his tail on fire and his tail will be burned up. And then he'll be the laughing stock of all the monkeys. That was Ravana's intelligence. Ravana never thought that he would be defeated by an ordinary human or by a monkey. Both Ramchandra, who was an ordinary earthling, supposedly, and Hanuman, who was a monkey. He was so proud, he's so puffed up by his opulence that he thought nothing could take him out, nothing could bring him down. That's what happens. You develop this tremendous ego. Modern civilization, they've got such a big ego. We don't need God. We need anything, we can buy it at Sainsbury's. If we need anything, we can go anywhere. We make the roads. We make the cars. We make the supermarkets. We make the rocket ships. We make the computers with little bugs in them sometimes. But so Ravana didn't know the power of Hanuman, who was Krishna's devotee. Hanuman actually had material potency, had siddhi, because Krishna gave it to him. Krishna can give any kind of siddhi to his devotee when it's required. When Arjuna was required to have strength, he defeated all the 11 Akshohinis of the Kauravas. He had an inferior army, Arjuna. It limited in many, many ways. Whereas the army of the Kauravas, there was no way that in normal circumstances that Arjuna should have been victorious in the battlefield. But because it was Krishna's desire and Arjuna was the instrument, Krishna gave him all the power to defeat the opposing enemy. And Krishna can give his devotee any kind of potency to do anything wonderful. Munkham karoti vachalam pangum langayate girim yat kripa tamaham bande paramananda madhava. You please Madhava, you please Krishna, and a lame man can walk, a blind man can see, a lame man can walk over mountains, not just walk. He can climb up Mount Everest if Krishna desires, or he can do anything. He can spread the Sankirtan movement in a world of atheistic demons. He can go to Chicago Airport and do 100 books a day to people you can't even stop for any other reason. Devotees were distributing in Chicago Airport. Some professional salesmen came out, and they were teasing the devotees that this is not very difficult. So the devotees said, oh yeah, here's some books. And they couldn't even stop people in the Chicago airport. Their people are running. It's a big airport, one of the largest airports in the world. And people were running to catch their connection, their planes. And they don't stop for anybody. Americans, the most cynical people in the world. You know, you go to New York to Port Authority, and you know, you try and say, "Have you got the time, sir?" Who wants to know? It's hard to stop them. So these guys couldn't stop anyone, but devotees were so empowered. Devotees would be out there on the tarmac distributing books, and someone would be walking down the tarmac, and the door, you'd snap his fingers. You, come here. The guy would come over. He'd walk away with a big stack of books and an empty wallet. They're empowered, Krishna's devotees. So Hanuman, he just picked up the pillar of the palace, a huge palace, and he just yanked out one of these giant pillars and began swinging it around, and he knocked out all the other pillars in the palace, just knocked them all out like candles on top of a birthday cake. He just smashed them to bits, and the whole palace came crashing down. And he lit all the different houses of all the generals and ministers of Ram, and he lit them all on fire with his burning tail, because Agni, Sita Devi, prayed to Agni that please appear cool. Here's a fire burning up all over Hanuman's tail, but he's feeling, ooh, it's cold. Ravan never thought of that. And so he just wandered all about Lanka, burning the whole place up. And within a few hours, this opulent, opulent place with coral walls and diamonds and rubies and everything that we value so much and get awe-inspired by, that excites our desires, makes us happy and joyful, it was just sodded. It was just dust. Powder. Ashes. That's the material world. Everything is ashes to ashes and dust to dust. So this is nice, this is beautiful. And Kardama took up his duty to satisfy his wife and did his responsible duty as a husband. It's very important that we are responsible in our lives. Whatever vows we take, we must stick to them. Whether you take the vows of a brahmachari or a sannyasi, or if you take the vows to be a Grihastha. It is your duty. You cannot say later on that I've changed my mind. No. You have to do your duty, because if you don't do your duty, if you take a vow, you don't, if you're not as good as your word, then that actually, you don't realize it, but it eats away at your own determination. It eats away at your own consciousness. And it disempowers you when you take a vow to do something and then you neglect it, frivolously especially. It just, you weaken, the person you really hurt is yourself more than anything else. You really hurt yourself. So whatever vows we take up, we have to execute them responsibly. But Kardama never lost sight of the goal. And he also was an empowered person. He was dealing with a lady from a very exalted background, and therefore they had a certain standard of opulence. We should never be envious of anyone's material opulence. I was just listening to a lecture. Srila Prabhupada was explaining that whatever we get in our lives according to our honest labor, not over-endeavor, not atyahara, but by our honest labor, whatever we get, we should be satisfied with that, whether we get a palace or whether we get a little hut. Be satisfied with that, engage in our service to Krishna, live peacefully, and look forward to going back to the spiritual world. By this process, balanced life, use your common sense, your good intelligence and your common sense, free from envy of anyone's material opulence, because we'll have to come in contact with so many different people with different standards of material opulence. But it's all dukkhalayam ashashvatam. Always remember that. Keep that verse foremost in your mind. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It's temporary, and there's so many miseries accompanying everything that is supposedly enjoyable. So many miseries is part and parcel. So the best you can do is live simply and ante narayana smriti, remember Krishna. That's the real opulence that we want. That's the real palace that we want to enter into. So there's some mention here. Prabhupada talks about skyscrapers. He used to say skyscrapers. I guess they weren't familiar with scrapers. But Vedic culture, of course, this is millions of years ago. Nothing's new under the sun. We're so smart, we think we've invented something wonderful, but there's nothing that hasn't been done before. So I'll stop there. Are there any comments or questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that one of the rewards for a successful yogi is the birth in a wealthy family. But that very birth actually is a question, but then it becomes a distraction. So how then is that reward?
Well, of the two, birth in a pious family is better. Suchinam Srimatam. So Suchi means pious family or brahminical family. So that is a greater blessing. But Prabhupada said he took birth in a wealthy, he was born in their relatives in the Mulik family, which was one of the wealthier families of Calcutta. But his father was also very pious. If you're wealthy, then it's really hard to be Krishna conscious if you can't even get enough food in your belly to keep your body alive. It, in fact, if you go to some African countries and see the Westerners have no idea of what opulence we're living in, really. If you go to some of the more destitute places of the world and see how people just struggle from morning to night just to feed their family, and usually they may have any kind of family, but usually half of them die by some disease or some famine or something or other. So, you know, you go to them and say, "Chant Hare Krishna, be happy, have no worries." You know, they want to shoot you in the head and eat you. So, yeah, it can be a blessing to be born in a family where you don't have to worry about material necessities at all. Then you can spend your time chanting Hare Krishna and reading the Shastras. And if you look into the lives of many of our great acharyas, Raghunath Das Goswami was not from a pauper's family. You know, he was... Prabhupada said his father had an income of 12 lakh rupees per month, and you know, 12 lakh rupees 600 years ago was a lot of rupees, or it was worth a lot of money. It was worth a lot of gold, whatever. And many of the big acharyas, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a very wealthy family. And like that. Kantraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki.